From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Donald Trump has promised to revive the U.S.'s nuclear capabilities, both in terms of upgrading weapon systems and more recently in offering government subsidies to nuclear power plants that are going bankrupt. But the track record of nuclear power, whether through weapons or power plants, is simply not well understood. Now, a new book by Fred Pierce takes us on a global tour of the nuclear age going back decades to the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, U.S. nuclear testing inside the country and outside, the Soviet Union's nuclear activities, and disasters like Chernobyl and Fukushima. Fred Pierce has reported on environmental science and development issues from 85 countries over the past 20 years. He was the environment consultant at New Scientist from 1992 to 2018 and writes regularly for The Guardian newspaper and Yale University's E360 website. His books include The New Wild, When the Rivers Run Dry, With Speed and Violence, Confessions of an Eco-Sinner, The Coming Population Crash, and The Land Grabbers. He now joins me to discuss his newest book, Fallout, Disasters, Lies, and the Legacy of the Nuclear Age. Welcome to the program, Fred Pierce.
Hi.
So what took you on this journey? You've written so many different books to explore not just nuclear weapons, but how nuclear power plants have fared over the many, many decades that we've sort of been in this nuclear age. It's a very ambitious adventure that took you, obviously, to many different parts of the world. What motivated you to want to explore this?
Well, it began as a journalistic commission. I'm a working journalist. And I went up to Sellafield, which is the British equivalent of Hanford, I guess you'd say, a centre of radioactive waste management, of reprocessing of spent fuel. They'd done everything up there. And there's a lot of radioactive mess around. And I went there and reported on that. And I've been on this case for a long time. Back in the 1980s, I worked for New Scientist magazine, and almost every week we had a story about some nuclear scandal up at Sellafield. Things had gone quiet since, so I was kind of intrigued about what was going on. And it turned from a study of Britain's nuclear industry into a look at the global industry. And I began to realize that what, when I was young, had been a kind of sunrise industry is now almost a sunset industry. Everything's shutting down. Power stations are shutting. Very few are being created. We're just left with a legacy of a huge amount of mess and fear, it has to be said, about nuclear activities around the world, whether you're in Russia or in Japan or the US or France or the UK. It seems to be much the same story. Nuclear is going away, but we're just left with this huge amount of mess. So the book is an attempt to explore that, to explore our nuclear history and the legacy that is being left behind.
So Donald Trump, our president here in the United States, is very excited about the prospect of nuclear power and weapons. He promised to revive the U.S.'s nuclear weapons, modernize the weapons, coming into office, wondered, why do we have all these weapons if we're not going to use them? And then more recently has actually promised to bail out nuclear power plants alongside coal that are going bankrupt. So this history, of course, is really critical to know, because I think certainly Trump isn't one to know much history or to even care to look into it, but at least the rest of the country can. And I was really intrigued by the history in your book about Nevada, the state of Nevada, where the U.S. in the 50s tested nuclear weapons, or maybe even going before that. Tell us that story of how nuclear testing even became something of a tourist phenomenon.
Oh, yeah. Back in the 50s, nuclear was the new thing. It was the new modern technology. It was a killing technology, but it also offered the prospect, people said, of electricity that would be too cheap to meter, they used to say. So everybody kind of wanted to get on the nuclear bandwagon. So football teams were being named nuclear. There were a sort of Miss Atomic Bomb contests held in Las Vegas, which was just down the road from the Nevada test site. It was a weird time. It was a time when America was alone in having nuclear weapons. The Russians and the British hadn't caught up at that point. So it was the height of American power, and nuclear weapons were seen as the ultimate symbol of American dominance in the world, and everybody kind of wanted part of that. And it culturally, it was really interesting. So the bikini, which, you know, two-piece swimsuit, first was invented in France in around that time, and they named it after the Bikini Atoll, which was suddenly famous in the news because the US was testing its new hydrogen weapons there. So like everybody wanted a piece of the action.
The Bikini Atoll, part of the Marshall Islands, where the U.S. did this testing of nuclear weapons. It's also a remarkable story, also somewhat out of the public eye. And so there isn't just fallout from actual use of nuclear weapons, such as in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and then disasters with nuclear power plants, such as Chernobyl or Fukushima, but the testing sites where countries like the U.S. deliberately let off weapons to study them before they used them. What is the situation with the Bikini Atoll, and how much is it an example of the kinds of situations where governments said the populations living in these places were simply expendable?
They were shipped out. I mean, they were moved off their islands and sent somewhere which ostensibly was safe, and people have been trying to go back ever since. And they've been told lots of stories about how, oh, it's safe to go back now, or we've cleaned the place up and you can go back now. And then they go back and they discover it's radioactive and they have to move out again. There are a lot of really seriously bad stories about how America in particular has treated the British as well, and the French too, but America in particular has treated the inhabitants of some of these Pacific islands and the Marshall Islands and elsewhere, who were just shipped out to allow the big powers to conduct their weapons tests. It's a pretty shameful episode.
The Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki are, of course, the best known sort of targets of any sort of nuclear power.
Well, they were the only places where anybody actually dropped a bomb in anger. Yes. You're right. Yes.
And where so many people were wiped out and the survivors lived for so many years with the consequences. You visited Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and past U.S. presidents have also now gone there to visit, and it's become this sort of reminder to us of what's of what nuclear power and weapons are capable of. But what did your visit there tell you in terms of how the people living there have kept up or understood the legacy of what happened to their cities?
Initially, it was tied up with the defeat of Japan in the war, and nobody talked about it for a long time. But Japan's relationship with nuclear power is really strange, because Japan then subsequently embraced the idea of nuclear power. It's got more nuclear energy than many countries in the world. And most people were very accepting of nuclear energy until the Fukushima accident after the tsunami there in 2011. And now people are very, very hostile to the idea of nuclear power at all. Most of the power stations were shut after that accident. The government wants to bring them back online. But by and large, local people, local authorities, municipal authorities won't allow that to happen. So they're mostly still offline. So there's been a complete change in Japan about their attitude from being very pro-nuclear to being very anti-nuclear, based on their experience at Fukushima, where for several days there was a huge accident going on and nobody told them what was going on. People literally didn't know whether they were going to die or not.
Now, there's been so much misinformation around Fukushima, not enough reporting on some of the real dangers of what happened there, and also some exaggerations of what the fallout from Fukushima has actually resulted in. From the mainstream news, that story seemed to basically disappear. From your research and the documentation in your book, what should we know about Fukushima? Fukushima is very far away geographically from the U.S.'s west coast, where I'm located, but, you know, we are connected by ocean currents.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think the risks to Americans from the Fukushima accident are pretty minimal. My my reporting suggests to me that, in fact, the releases were very substantial, but were much less than, for instance, at the Chernobyl accident in Ukraine in the 1980s. Much of the area which was evacuated, probably people could go back there now. It's, you know, the Japanese have done a huge job of trying to clean up the mess, They've stripped off the soil, they've removed vegetation, they've done a lot of work to try and clean it up. But people, understandably, don't want to go back because they don't trust the authorities anymore to tell them the truth about radiation and about nuclear hazards. And that's highly understandable given the history of lies that they've been told. So there's a kind of double tragedy there. For many of the towns that are still evacuated, people could go back, but nobody has the trust to go back. So they're not able to go home because they would be too fearful to go home. So it's a kind of double tragedy, the tragedy of the accident itself and the tragedy of the loss of trust. And that's one, I mean, that's not just in Japan, that's a global phenomenon. People don't trust authorities when they talk about nuclear power. And that's partly because of a history of deceit, a history of secrecy, a history of lies. And it all kind of goes back to the nuclear weapons story, because the civilian nuclear power industry is still pretty tightly connected to the military side, especially because they're using the same technology. And many of the waste products produced from civilian power stations could be used for nuclear weapons or attacked by terrorists. It's a, you know, it's a nasty mix, and I don't think it's going to go away.
No discussion about the nuclear age is complete without talking about Russia, the USSR, and the Cold War. And the, you know, we talked a little bit about U.S. Testing, nuclear testing here in the United States. What about Soviet testing within the Soviet states and the Soviet era? You write in your book about the test at Semipalatinsk. Tell us that story. And how it was, you know, the people living in the region where the Soviets did their testing were simply, you know, assumed to not exist.
That's right. This was done in what was supposedly a sort of desert region of Kazakhstan, which is certainly a long way from Moscow. But there are people live there, and there are industrial towns around. And there are some rather scary stories about clouds of radioactive debris from dirty tests being carried out by the Russians in the Kazakh desert, which didn't just disperse on the winds, but kind of formed a plume that went in a couple of cases east and northeast and rained out on villages and, in one case, quite a large industrial town. And of course, you know, people were getting sick. There was a big cover-up went on. I stumbled across some data that was provided to me by Kazakh scientists from government agency. Kazakhstan is now very strongly anti-nuclear because of experience in the Soviet times, pointing out to me that there was credible evidence that probably hundreds of people died in just one test, and who knows how many there were. And we now know that health people came from Moscow to check out the food there and found it heavily contaminated. But of course, the locals were never told. And the Russians did that inside Russia as well. Behind the Urals, they had their own version of Hanford, a plutonium manufacturing plant, which sent huge amounts of very radioactive waste down local rivers, rivers that people were using for drinking, would you believe, and had their cattle on there. Quite staggering disregard for human life, and lots of deaths which were secretly monitored by doctors from the Soviet Union who were not even allowed to tell their patients what was going on. A long-running scandal, and it took 40 years in the end of the Soviet Union before the victims of this were even told what had been happening in their midst.
And then we did have the disaster at Chernobyl, which is one of the best known historical nuclear disasters, nuclear power plant disasters. Yeah. You've gone there.
Civilian disaster, undoubtedly. It was you couldn't imagine a worse accident, really.
So you've gone there in the what's called the exclusion zone, because the area is still at least officially considered too dangerous to inhabit. But you've met people who call themselves self-settlers and have gone back in to try to live in on their land. Tell us that story.
Well, they have. Many people were evacuated from an area of about 20 miles all around the plant. That area remains officially evacuated. More than 100 villages were simply emptied and razed to the ground, chopped down. Some people didn't accept the being thrown out, and they stealthily went back, and they kind of hid in their old villages and holed up in places no electricity. They had to go back to old contaminated wells. The official authorities eventually accepted them, and there have been about 2,000 there. They've been there, some of them, for 30 years, and they live in this radioactive landscape. Has to be said, many of them, I don't have any scientific studies to prove it, but many of them seem to have been living to a ripe old age without coming to any great harm. And that is also reflected, actually, in the wildlife in that area. There's an awful lot of wildlife in the exclusion zone, simply because while wildlife may not like the radioactivity, it loves the fact that there aren't many people there. So the bears and the wolves and the lynx and other animals have come back, and they're in some numbers. It's kind of like a rewilding area, if you like, a radioactive rewilding in the center of Europe. So it's a really strange place to go. Now, I wouldn't live there. I think the water and the vegetation and everything is just too contaminated. I wouldn't dream of living there. But there are people who've gone back and have lived out the remains of their lives, slowly dying out now, but usually from diseases unconnected with radiation. They're just reaching the end of their days. Really weird place.
Now, in your travels, of course, you did expose yourself, I'm sure, to contamination in going to some of these places. But as you've said, there are people who still live there and who choose to live there. I feel like despite the fact that our world and heads of state have been so cavalier about using this technology, they've done so with still not enough of an understanding of how the technology impacts our environment, our bodies, our water, our air, how to properly control this technology. Do you feel that we just have unleashed this genie from the bottle, you know, several decades ago, and are still trying to find ways to stuff it back in?
Well, I think we have. I mean, politically, I think we've not found a way of living with this technology. I think it's true that some environmentalists, some people that I know well and would trust on other things, rather exaggerate some of the radiation effects of some of these things. As you can see from the area around Chernobyl, that it's possible to live in some of these apparently very contaminated areas. So we can over dramatize some of the radiation risks, but there are still huge problems with the proliferation risk of weapons, but also the radioactive waste that we're creating, both from bomb making and from nuclear power plants. No country in the world yet has a place to bury this radioactive waste, much of which will be has a half-life of tens of thousands of years. It's extremely radioactive. We don't know how to handle it. So there are these legacy issues that we're passing on to future generations. The plutonium stores especially are a huge issue. We really have no right to be passing that on to future generations without having developed the technology for handling it. So yeah, there are huge risks in here. I think sometimes we overestimate some of the risks, but the waste risk, the waste legacy that we're passing on to future generations, even just cleaning up old power stations as they come out of use, is a huge thing, and we really haven't got to the bottom of that. So there are a lot of unanswered questions about this technology. We rushed into it in a great hurry in wartime because, you know, we wanted the bomb, or we were worried that the Germans, Nazis, were developing a bomb, so America had to have it. And then America tried to, you know, dropped it on Japan, and then the Russians got it, and the British and the French, and, you know, other people too. So we unleashed this kind of genie from the bottle. It's going to be very difficult to put it back.
And yet there are still diplomatic relations and tensions between nations that center on the nuclear question. Iran, of course, North Korea, and with the United States, this potential revival of the nuclear power industry under Trump. There was this bizarre article in Forbes a couple of days ago that pointed out that Trump's revival of nuclear power through government subsidies may help the U.S. meet its goals of the Paris Accord on the issue of climate. You know, and some people have offered nuclear power as an antidote to carbon-intensive fossil fuel production. So are there some forces in the planet that are attempting to revive this nuclear age and keep it going?
They are. They're fighting against, in terms of nuclear energy, they're fighting against the economics. Nuclear energy is a low carbon source of energy, so we shouldn't dismiss it perhaps in a time of fear about climate change. But there are many other technologies, solar and wind power, which are substantially cheaper now and don't have the same waste problems as nuclear power. So while some people want to revive it, I think those people who should be trying to fix the waste problems before they think about doing that. As regards weapons, we have huge stockpiles of plutonium to produce many, many thousands more weapons. I really hope that we don't do it. But even if Trump wanted to rearm America, he's got plenty of plutonium. He doesn't need more nuclear reactors to that. All that plutonium is currently sitting in store around the country. We ought to be thinking about getting rid of that stuff rather than using it.
How do we get rid of that stuff? That's another big question. What does one do with nuclear waste if one makes a commitment, as is the hope of so many sort of nuclear abolitionists, that we come to an age where nuclear power, nuclear weapons are no longer something we rely on? How do we get rid of the mess that's been made?
Well, you have to make it safe and bury it underground. The one small thing I would agree with Trump about is that he is in favor of reviving the Yucca Mountain project in Nevada as a waste burial ground. Actually, I think he's right there. We cannot simply have radioactive waste in silos all the way across the country. You've got to bring it all together in one place and bury it out of harm's way. It's not an ideal solution, but since we have this stuff, we've got to do something with it. But let's do that before we think about anything else. Just remember on weapons, years ago, America and Britain and everybody else signed a non-proliferation treaty, which said that in return for countries like Iran and North Korea and Israel and many others for not developing nuclear weapons, we would agree to phase out ours. We now go around the world insisting that Iran and people don't develop nuclear weapons, but we're not phasing out ours. Exactly. We haven't fulfilled our side of the bargain. So it's kind of understandable that much of the rest of the world that doesn't have nuclear weapons gets a little angry with countries like Britain and the US and Russia and China too, getting on our high horses and talking about how nobody else should have weapons, only we should have the weapons. We promised to get rid of ours, and we're really doing virtually nothing about that now.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Fred, for joining us today and spending this time with us. Is there a website you'd like to recommend? Where can people find out more about your work?
I just go and find the book, Fallout. It's a good book. I recommend reading it.
It is indeed a good book. Thank you again, Fred.
Okay, pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
My guest has been Fred Pierce. He has reported on environmental, science, and development issues from 85 countries over the past 20 years. He was the environment consultant at New Scientist from 1992 to 2018, and he writes regularly for The Guardian newspaper and Yale University's E360 website. His books include The New Wild, When the Rivers Run Dry, With Speed and Violence, Confessions of an Eco-Sinner, The Coming Population Crash, and The Land Grabbers. And we've been discussing his newest book, Fallout: Disasters, Lies, and the Legacy of the Nuclear Age. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.